Thank you for all your texts. The reason we're talking about commuting costs is we'll find out today what the maximum amount that regulated rail fares can increase by next year. It's based on a measure of inflation called RPI, the Retail Prices Index, which the Office for National Statistics calculates looking at a certain basket of goods. But it's not the one that we normally talk about each month. But with that running relatively high at the moment, around 3.5%, it could mean some of the biggest increases to ticket prices since 2012. Around half of rail fares are regulated. And the RMT union claims since 2010, we heard Mickey mention in this earlier, rail fares have increased twice as much as pay has, all part of that squeeze we've been talking about. However, taxpayers still subsidise services by £5 billion last year. So who should be forking out for the improvements to our trains and tracks? Stephen Gibson is from SLG Economics, former head of economics at Network Rail as well. Stephen, good morning.
Good morning.
So who should be paying for this? Where's the debate heading at the moment?
Well, this is really a government policy decision of should it be the rail passengers who pay, they're the people that get the benefit, they use the service, or should it be subsidised by the government? Now, there are a number of train services, particularly the rural and regional services, where if you didn't have a large amount of government subsidy, the services simply wouldn't run. But there are also services, like many of the services in around London and the South East, where train operators are making very substantial profits on their lines.
And is that getting put back in?
In some cases it is, yes. I mean, we're seeing unprecedented levels of investment in some of the electrification and other capacity increases. And in some cases it's being used to improve new trains, new rolling stock, which provides sort of air conditioning and higher capacity journeys in the capacity-constrained areas.
It's interesting, Stephen, if you listen to Chris Grayling when he talks about the railways, the first thing he always tells you, of course, is that we are investing $30 billion or $40 billion, whatever the sum is, in railways at the moment. But he doesn't make any mention of the fact that for the past half a century, they've invested very little into rails, going back to the days of the slam door. So really, it's a bit of a catch-up process. Do we need to look at railways and decide how they're funded and what exactly we need them for?
Yeah, you make a very good point about we are now paying for some of the underinvestment of previous generations. But if we want to continue the increase pay for the increased investment, there's not much we can do about that. We've seen 50% increase in passenger numbers and a massive increase in freight using our railways, and that's something really we want to encourage. I mean, the environmental costs, the safety benefits, and generally, the ability to get lorries and cars off the road has got to be a good thing.
But the point I'm making is that the philosophy of successive governments in the past 20 years has been that the rail traveller will pay for the investment. And what I'm saying to you is that fair? And is it practical? Because do we need the railways? How many railways in the Western world are running profitably on investment from passengers at the moment?
Well, you're absolutely right. There is a government political decision of how much is paid for by passengers versus how much is paid for by taxpayers. And the government looked at this last in about 2007 and decided that it was the amount that was being paid by taxpayers was too high, and they were looking to rebalance that. And that's why they've gradually increased the amount that's being paid by passengers. But I think it's very difficult to compare our railways with the railway structure that you have in, say, France or Germany, most of which were substantially rebuilt in the 1950s after the war, where they've been totally demolished. So what you have there is you have railway networks that were designed for 150-mile-an-hour or 200-mile-an-hour electric and diesel railways. Our railway system was designed in the 1850s for 50-mile-an-hour steam trains. It's a very, very different...
And runs through very congested areas, of course.
Absolutely. It runs through areas where there's no option to sort of expand the railway structure. The tunnels are the size they are, so you can't have the double-decker trains that they have in France and Germany, and the platforms are the length they are, so you can't have longer trains that would have higher capacity and more carriages. So
Stephen,
we are stuck with the railway system we've got.
Just before you go, so it's regulated rail fares affected at 9:30 today when we hear those price increases. What does that mean, regulated rail fares? Who should be keeping an ear out for this?
OK, so regulated rail fares, about 45% of all the fares. That covers fares such as standard and saver fares, weekly season tickets, but doesn't include the first-class fares or advanced purchase fares.
Gotcha. Brilliant. Thank you, Stephen. We'll keep an eye out for that. Stephen Gibson there from SLG Economics. You're all right with your first-class fares, Mickey. We won't find out about how much they're changing until later in the year.
Well, you get first-class travelling on a Sunday, don't you?